I imagine I might have gotten chosen to be the moderator because I've been doing a little bit of research on Mennonite cookbooks, but also probably because I like to talk about food. Those of you who know my dad know that that's a strong heritage in our family. About my mother, and about a meal that my mom made for me one time. The many thousands of meals my mom made for me during my childhood exist now in a mostly hazy ideal of our family gathered in the parsonage's bright kitchen, cocooned by Kansas, dark winter, eating soup and homemade bread. Or later, when we lived in Oregon, the late summer, dusk, warming us as we ate roll cooking on our deck. My mom is a great cook, and although I can't recall what she made throughout my childhood, I remember her cooking as wholesome, tasty, and taken for granted by my family. Only one meal remains vivid in my mind, its memory neither hazy nor idyllic, its construction only wholesome but not tasty. Our family had moved from the Mennonite Mecca in Kansas, where even the school cafeteria served burak and brenica, to Oregon, where people confused Mennonites with Mormons, and even my church peers didn't know a plumimos from a Jell-O salad. Yet when I invited a new high school friend for dinner, I hadn't even considered the possibility of a cultural clash. Of course, my parents embarrassed me, that goes without saying. My dad's career as a pastor and the badly sewn clothes my mom made, sorry mom, were a constant shame. But I figured one meal seemed harmless until mom put a More with Less cookbook mainstay on the table, assuring my adolescent mortification. The meal was called Savory Baked Lima Dish. I imagine my mom served other popular More with Less items with the bean bake, but I only recall that bean bake, the big lima beans swimming in a yellow casserole dish. I scooped out a small spoonful on my friend's plate, apologizing. And while my friend swore she liked the casserole, I knew she was lying and that my family would be forever labeled odd for serving such strange but healthy fare. In many ways, this More with Less story exemplifies the relationship I had with my mother and with being Mennonite. The More with Less itself was emblematic of my mother's role in our family. She was the nurturer who cooked our meals and met our needs. She was the financial watchdog, compelling our family to live simply. And she was the conduit of our Mennonites' tradition for her own ties to ethnic Mennonites defined our family's Mennonite identity, not my father's much later conversion. In this, I am not unlike many other Mennonites for whom food is intricately tied to ethnic and even religious identity. Indeed, scholars are increasingly recognizing the importance of food in understanding culture, and thus in understanding a people's group history. For this reason, historians are spending more time looking at how Mennonite domesticity, foods, cookbooks, and in-home practices reflect changes in the North American Mennonite church at large. Historians often write about larger movements that help define a nation or a people group, including wars, elections, the activities of powerful leaders. But just as often, the seeming minutiae of life can give us clues to the history and to what was important to certain people in a certain time. In the book, Mennonite Women in Canada, A History, Marlene Epp writes about Mennonite cookbooks, arguing that cookbooks initiated and produced by women shaped both Mennonite cultural understanding and generated external perceptions and knowledge about Mennonite historical development and sociological identity. So today at our fall meeting, we're going to talk about food. Our presentation this afternoon differs in many ways from those we've had in the past, in great part because we are having more than one presenter, and in part because these presenters will be sharing stories more personal in nature, though I'm a firm believer in the power of personal narratives to reflect larger movements in history. In some ways, it will be up to you, the listener, to think about how the stories connect to Mennonite faith, identity, and history. And after we hear from several people, there will be hopefully time to talk about the connections you have and how your memories about food reflect the Mennonite world you were raised in. Our first presenter today will be joining us via video. Shirley Showalter, who was president of Goshen College from 1997 to 2004, will be reading from her excellent memoir, Blush, which is due out this week. And as an aside, I just want to make a plug for the book Blush, which was an astounding memoir about her life growing up in Lancaster County. Shirley's upbringing was as a conservative Mennonite, and her memoir details the ways she was nurtured and challenged by this environment. In a chapter on the seven sweets and seven sours, Shirley writes about the ways Mennonite food traditions of her heritage reflected the place and time in which he lived. Again, I'm grateful that Shirley was willing to share her story via video with us, and I'm crossing my fingers that it's going to work. So go ahead.
I'm Shirley Hershey Showalter, and my new book is called Blush, A Mennonite Girl Meets a Glittering World. I'm going to be reading an excerpt from my book entitled Seven Sweets and Seven Sours. Almost every culture and religion uses food to support its most cherished values. If it's true that we are what we eat, then I am a sweet-sour person. Like most people, I love the food of my childhood. It is my comfort food, even after enjoying many other cuisines. Pennsylvania Dutch Food, my childhood staff of life, is famous for its seven sweets and seven sours, a cuisine both bland and pungent. Above all, this style of cooking focuses on abundance. It got its name because all 14 of those flavors were supposedly included in one true Pennsylvania Dutch meal. Without seven desserts or sweet condiments and seven vinegar-laden side dishes, you didn't have a feast. The label, Seven Sweets and Seven Sours, might well have been concocted by the tourist industry, but it has stuck. Lining the Lincoln Highway between Lancaster and Philadelphia are a host of places that compete to offer tourists the real Pennsylvania Dutch dining experience. No one seems to know why the number seven and why sweets and sours are singled out to the exclusion of the other taste buds found on the human tongue. But my grandmother's spiral-bound cooking notebook and the Mennonite community cookbook, which was gleaned from many such notebooks, offers a clue. The seven sweets and seven sours are light on vegetables, no need for recipes for those, and heavy on desserts and pickles. Seven sweets and seven sours also seems a perfect metaphor for my complex relationship with the Mennonite Church. Any cultural group that carries on a tradition separate from the world, yet borrows selectively from other groups and traditions, will create a unique taste culture. In the case of the Pennsylvania Dutch, who had an abundance of pork and flour from the colonial era onward, and who performed taxing physical labor all their lives, the emphasis was on dough, noodles, and dumplings as accompaniments to fatty meat. Since there was so much fat to absorb, vinegar and/or fruit juices became a way to cut the fat. The love of food, prepared well in large quantities, was so great among my kin that we risked one of the classic deadly sins, gluttony. I heard a lot about sin as I was growing up. The seven deadly ones included pride, envy, gluttony, lust, anger, greed, and sloth. The only one I never heard preached about was gluttony. If Mennonites needed a sinful outlet, a transgression they could overlook, perhaps gluttony was their safety valve. They could make up for the tolerance of one vice by denouncing the others more vigorously. Seven deadly sins. Seven sweets. Seven sours. They all include the perfect number 7 contained in biblical bookends, the 7 days of creation in Genesis, and the 7 seals of Revelation. The Hebrew word for 7, Shavah, is closely connected to Sabah, meaning fullness or plenty. So perhaps 7 sweets and 7 sours carry sacred meaning we didn't recognize. The feeling of physical and social and spiritual well-being, of eating a meal overflowing with every kind of food, and extended family and friendship did, at least sometimes, seem holy. Theological background aside, what would a 7 sweets and 7 sours menu actually look like? The 7 sours are largely side dishes: pepper cabbage, pickled beets, red beet eggs, and chow chow, a beautiful combination of pickled corn, lima beans, green beans, cucumbers, green pepper, red pepper, and onions. The 7 sweets tradition includes up to 20 kinds of pies. Most are fruit or custard, but the king of all pies is shoofly. Shoofly is simple and inexpensive to make, from molasses, flour, brown sugar, eggs, butter, and water. It tastes best when served warm with hand-whipped cream on top. What pecan pie is to the South, shoofly is to the Pennsylvania Dutch. Everyone's childhood is some mixture of sweet and sour. My Mennonite childhood was sweetest when surrounded by family, including the 40 families in our church, who called me by name and knew where I lived, what grade I was in, and what part I sang when we opened the hymnals together. A phrase from a new hymn describes this kind of community perfectly. We are each other's bread and wine. It was easy to imagine Jesus eating with his disciples when we sat down to a meal. We knew that our job would be to care for the people cast out by the rest of society, the strangers, the way Jesus did. It took me years to notice some of the sour among the sweetness of our church. Now I see the irony that Mennonites thought it necessary, in order to follow Jesus as perfectly as possible, to exclude those who dressed or talked loud, divorced, drank, or danced, unless they repented. If they were ever in a disaster, we would come to their aid. But if they wanted to join our church, they would have to adopt plain dress and a modest lifestyle, following the ordinances in the Statement of Christian Doctrine and Rules and Discipline of the Lancaster Conference of the Mennonite Church. After baptism, women would have to grow their hair long and put it under a covering and give up all vices except gluttony before we would let them in. I discovered along the way that most groups had some kind of sourness hidden in them. I began to see that identity formation always includes an us and a them. It's easy to see all sweetness in us and all sour in them. Though my branch of the Mennonite Church has relaxed the rules requiring church members to be plain, I admire many conservative Mennonites who continue to maintain boundaries between the plain church and the glittering world. We still get together for family reunions and in service activities like Mennonite disaster service and relief sales. What brings us together best? Food.
All right, so that's just one chapter in Shirley's excellent, excellent memoir. And I was just informed there is shoofly pie here for us to enjoy afterwards. I know some of you probably want to scramble to the kitchen now. Before we move on, Judy Bacher was supposed to speak at the end. Somebody accidentally picked up her script in the kitchen, so can you look through your effects to make sure that nobody has it? And you can give it to Judy if you find it among your stuff. Okay. Our next presenter is Jerry Barkman, who is the current president of the Pacific Northwest Mennonite Historical Society. I don't know enough about Jerry's story to know how much his perspective will be different or similar to Shirley Showalter, so look forward to hearing what Jerry has to say.
Thank you, Melanie. In order to give you some perspective on what I'm saying, going to say this afternoon, let me give you some personal background. I am a native of Hillsboro, Kansas, and if you know the Mennonite Brethren, from whom I came, actually first Crimer Mennonite Brethren, but then the Mennonite Brethren, Hillsboro is the Mecca. All Mennonite Brethren used to bow toward Mecca when they did their devotions. Hillsboro is a small town of 3,000 people. At the time I was growing up, it was between 2,000 and 3,000, so it hasn't grown a great deal. In the town were seven churches, five of them Mennonite, and the other one was Methodist Evangelical, and the seventh was Missouri Synod Lutheran. And so we had great amount of church influence in growing up. My family, the Barkman and the Jost, my mother was from the Jost family. Both of those families find their origin in the Molochna colony of what was then South Russia, now the Ukraine. And so when I do family research, it is easier for me to do it because most of the sources deal with South Russia or the Ukraine. Fortunately, there are some very good resources that have to do with Mennonite food, and I brought the two books that I think probably are the best of the Mennonite, South Russia Mennonite literature, and that is a two-volume series written by Norma Jost Voth. Norma was a second cousin to my mother, and so she also grew up in Hillsboro. The last I'd heard, she lived in Central California, actually in San Jose. She probably is in her 90s at this point in age. It's called Mennonite Food and Folkways from South Russia, and it's an excellent two-volume set. I have my own copy here. We do have a set, I think, in the archives at Zion, at the Krupp Center. And so if you're interested further, you can take a look at those. Just a quick 3-minute look at the history. And I do this because as I put together my presentation, I realized that it really is historically driven. The earliest evidence of Mennonites in what is now Poland, goes far as back as 1550, or possibly 1560. It is said that Menno Simons actually visited the Mennonites in exile in the Danzig area of what is now Poland. Over the years, a significant number of Mennonites immigrated to Poland, which became known as Prussia, East Prussia, West Prussia, because of the issue of religious persecution. In Prussia, they were given a freedom, but there were fair number of restrictions. By 1789, just before 1789, Catherine the Great opened up a vast amount of land in South Russia and invited people from Europe to come to South Russia, and the Mennonites took up the invitation, and in 1789, the first Mennonites came to Ukraine and formed the Kortytsa colony. In 1804, the second large wave of immigration came from Prussia, Poland, and formed what is known as the Molochna colony. Molochna was larger, and in the literature today you will hear the word old colony referred to, that is normally referred to as the Kortytsa colony. And so in this historical perspective, you begin to realize the influences of food, the influence on food and what they ate. The Danzig area of Poland, the Mennonites were early restricted to farming. And so most of what you find is farming. And so you would imagine that the things that the people ate were what they could grow on the farms. Later, there was a movement of Mennonites to Danzig, or the city of Gdańsk as we know it today. And so it widened out. And so what happened then when the immigration occurred into South Russia was that the major occupation of the earliest immigrants was farming. Later it became different, but essentially that's what you have. And so the Mennonite experience in South Russia is really around farming. And as Shirley Showalter said in her presentation, around food. And I have to say that in my early days, as I remember them now, 70 years later or 60 years later, is that much of our social life in Hillsboro did center around the church and around food and around fellowship around the table. and so let me just give you a little bit of the cuisine of South Russia. The first one, the number one thing that you have to remember if you take anything home with you is that the center of the cuisine was wheat. And in fact, in the annals of the state of Kansas, there is a proclamation giving honor to the Mennonites who brought the turkey red wheat, the hard winter wheat, to Kansas, which actually is the basis of the Kansas wheat industry. It was brought by the earliest immigrants in 1874, and so what you have in Oregon, you have spring wheat, which is soft wheat. In Kansas, it's by and large turkey red or its descendants. So that number one is wheat. Number two is what you could produce in a garden, and so the predominant things that you would eat would be potatoes, and it's interesting that potatoes only became a staple in Mennonite cuisine, at least in South Russia, prior to actually coming to South Russia. Cucumbers, either pickled or raw, beans, corn, peas, tomatoes, known in the Russian as the baklazhan. The tomatoes actually were not eaten by the Mennonites until they got to Russia. And they hesitated very much to eat raw baklazhan. They used them in soup, and they canned them, and it's only as things developed that they began to appreciate them. One of the early Mennonites was quoted as saying he ate sugar with his tomatoes. Or he ate tomatoes with his sugar, I take it the other way. And he couldn't stand to eat a tomato without sugar in it. So that was one of the primary, missing from the list that my wife and I were looking at is squash. There's no mention. Norma Jostvoth does not mention squash. Interesting. Lettuce was a summer fresh vegetable, and cabbage, of course, was a main staple in the borscht that the Mennonites ate, in contrast to the beets, which the Russians ate in their borscht. So when we talk about Mennonite borscht, you can remember that the major difference is cabbage instead of beets. One of the vegetables which became the Mennonites became known for was watermelon, arbuz. And Norma Jostvoth states that it came out of Turkey and South Russia. The Mennonites early adapted watermelon and managed to be able to eat watermelon in various forms from its early time in midsummer to actually till Christmas. They were able to eat it. Elder Jacob Wiebe, when he came to Hillsboro as the leader of the Cremer Mennonite Brethren Church, was known as Mr. Watermelon. And it is said by Noble Prentice, who was a well-known publisher in Kansas, that if you went to the Gananoque village in Marion County, Kansas, make sure that you visit with him, because when you leave, he will give you as many watermelon as you can take with you. And so they enjoyed watermelon. It was a great food. And we have the crawler, which I traditionally love to eat with fresh watermelon. A crawler is I don't know what it's called. I'm always reminded of a maple bar without the maple. It's a little bit heavier than that. But the crawler was what we ate. And so, because there was no refrigeration in the winter, the staples were things that they canned. And so all of the vegetables that they canned, that they grew in the summer were canned and stored if they could, particularly root vegetables like potatoes, carrots, and a few others that were strange to me, and because my mother never made them. When we turn to the issue of fruit, one of the things that Johann Kornes encouraged in South Russia was the growth of the growth of fruit trees. Johann Kornes was an interesting man. When the Mennonites first came to Russia in 1789, agriculture was at a fairly low level. And soon after, as part of the Molochna colony, a young man named Johann Kornes came to the attention of the Russian government departments, and he was given tremendous power to encourage the growth of agricultural means in the colonies. He was given enough power to the point where many Mennonites, particularly the religious groups, resented the power that Johann Kornes had. But one of the things that he really encouraged was the growth of fruit trees. And in the plans for the villages, you have every house had, every farmstead had an orchard. And you had cherry trees, you had plum trees, you had apple trees. And later, as he encouraged the growth of the silk industry, which you don't probably know, he encouraged the growth of mulberry trees, because silkworms eat mulberry leaves. And so in our farm in Kansas, grandfather's farm, we had at least a half a dozen very large mulberry trees, which great-grandfather Peter had planted when he took over the land, homesteaded the land in Kansas. Mulberry was a normal fruit crop, just like apples and oranges. And by the way, rhubarb was also grown and eaten as part of the cuisine. In the growing of livestock, it's interesting to me that cattle were not considered a food staple. Cows were not grown for their meat. In fact, it was only later on that Mennonites began to learn how to cook it. Cows were grown for the dairy products, milk, cheese, cottage cheese, whatever you can make from milk, that's what you used cows for. And very few of them used cattle for draft animals, that is, for plowing and so forth. That was left for horses and oxen. Later on, or early on, about 1825, sheep became, the growing and tending of sheep became a large thing. And at one point, they figured 350,000 sheep in the Molochna colony, which it soon died out, because by the time they came to Kansas, there were almost no sheep involved with the Mennonites that I'm aware of, at least in Kansas. The primary meat animal for the Mennonites was the pig. And if you look at the cuisine, if you look at the recipes in the books, You will note that sausage was a tremendously important part of the diet for the reason that it was something that you could produce in the fall in preparation for winter, and that you could then store in the right way through the winter. And so that's really interesting. When I moved to Hope Village, one of our residents brought to me the diary of his grandfather, Grandfather Friesen, who immigrated to Hillsborough. And in the diary, which had been translated from the German to English, he made note of the butchering of hogs in the fall, in September. And he made a very important point that of how much lard they rendered out of the pig. And as I looked at it, I questioned that, and it came to me that, of course, lard was a central part of the cuisine of the Mennonites. It was used in baking, it was used in frying, and so it was the primary fat component of their diet rather than beef fat or suet. And so there's much made of the butchering of hogs in the fall for the winter. Now, let me give you some specific dishes that you might have heard of. The first one, and if you don't remember anything about Russian Mennonite food, you got to remember the tvebak. Okay? Tvebak is the Low German name, right, Tina? It's tvebak. And it's not zwiebak, it's tvebak. Now, it might be in Dutch, it might be zwiebak. But it is the oldest single known component of Mennonite cuisine is the tvebak. There are records in Holland 3 centuries earlier where they talk about the zwiebak, and it means, depending on how you translate the word, it's either two parts, two buns, okay, or it actually could mean twice baked. Okay? Now what is it? It is a very light dough bun, probably about that size, with a smaller bun on top of it, okay? You have to have you don't make them with the same size bun on the top and the bottom. You always have to have the small one on the top, right? And they're baked to a golden brown, and there's nothing better than a fresh zwieback smell when you walk into the house. And so the zwieback, and it was the staple, and you know, it's like a taste of heaven, actually. What is tastier, actually, to me, is a resche zwieback, which is a second roasting. So you take, and usually in my mother would, if there were any left over, and it doesn't happen very often, she would just lay them on an open pan, put them in the oven at a low temperature, and roast them till they were fairly hard. And there's evidence in Danzig that there were bakers who made resche zwieback, and the sailors bought them for victualling the ships. So between the British hard tack and the Mennonite resche zwieback, that must have been quite a cuisine. So that's the number one. The second one is the Vedenica. Okay? Now, the Vedenica is, in fact, not Dutch. It is the national dish of the Ukraine. It was brought, historic study shows that it was brought to the Ukraine by the Tartars, who came out of the steppes of Russia. And the primary filling is cottage cheese, as we would call it. But properly in Plautdeutsch, or Low German, it is known as glums. Okay? Glums is a byproduct of milk that's separating. Now, my father's two brothers and sister never married. When my grandfather passed away, they bought the farm. So I grew up with these three uncles and aunts, and they were only 2 miles away from my parents. So there was a lot of relationship going back and forth. Well, Aunt Tina, Catherine, would call Mom and say, "Helen, I have a fresh mix of glums. Come and get it." So my mother would grab her big pan as whatever she wanted, and we'd get in the car and we'd go 2 miles down to Tina's place, and we would buy glums, or buy it. She would give us glums. It looks like cottage cheese, only it's a little finer. It's got slightly different taste. You can make Vedenica with cottage cheese, but that's really a second best product. And then I knew that we would, within the next 2 days, have Vedenica. And there are dumplings about that big in size, depending on how big you make them. And in my best days, I could eat 7, maybe 8 of them. And you always, at least my mother always served them with country sausage, with a country sausage gravy, which you can just taste. And that would be, and fresh zwieback, of course. And that would be a supper fit for a king. And so the Vedenica, and it's different actually from the Polish, Marge, what is the Polish? The Bierok. Okay, the Vedenica is considered a boiled product. That is, you put it in hot water. You make the Vedenica up and you put it in hot water. The Bierok is baked. That's probably the main difference between the two. And the Bierok is either Polish or Russian, not sure. So that was probably one of the things that I remember the most. Then we had what was known as kilkia. Kilkia are noodles. They're small bits of dough that are cooked very much like you would cook pasta today. We would have kilkia with chicken. Of course, that's chicken noodle soup. That's the closest you could come to that. And the last one that I want to just say is mos. Okay, now, I was going to ask this at the beginning. I'll ask you now. How many of you come from the Russian Mennonite background? There are a few. So when I say mos, you know what I'm talking about, do you? How do you define it? What do you call it? What is it? Pudding? Fruit soup. That's probably the best. That is probably the best. It's a flour-based pudding, but you can make it with every kind of fruit you want. You can do dried fruit, like dried apricots, prunes. You can do fresh plums. You can do cherries. You can do sour cherries, sweet cherries, dried cherries. You could put apples in it. The one I really kind of liked the least was gooseberry. I always pick I'd find the gooseberries down at the creek, and then I'd pick a half a can and take them back to Aunt Tina, and then I knew we were going to have gooseberry mos, which is pretty sour. But mos was a staple on the farm. And so the other thing that I'll just mention now in passing, chickens were the primary fowl that were eaten. Every farm had a group of hens. And so the chicken were there. Ducks and geese actually were grown quite widespread, and were used, the duck and the goose were used mostly for summer or for Sunday dinner and so forth. Once in a while, you'll see a recipe for squab, which they would catch. They would catch the baby or the young pigeons. Now, just in conclusion, I'm going to end up. My earliest memory of this kind of food really does center around the family. The traditional Mennonite FOSPA was Sunday evening. Depending on what was early, if we had church in the evening, we were earlier. If we didn't have church, then we would go later. We were always invited to someone's home. Either mother, the parents would invite them to our house, or we would go. And because we were related to half the people in either the church or the town, it was always family and close friends. And there was something about eating that food together and sharing the table with each other that I think in our neck of the woods was an important thing for us to have. And so that's South Russian cuisine. I encourage you to look. The volume one of the book really is fine. And if you can get a copy of it, it's a good publications out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, publish it. So take a look at it. And so happy eating.
Thank you, Jerry. I think I've been saying Zwieback wrong all these years. And I brought some today, so I'm feeling all kinds of pressure now because it's clear you're a connoisseur of those. My family calls them flying saucers, which always irritates me a little bit. So for both Shirley and Jerry, food reflects their Mennonite ethnicities, their culture, the history, as Mennonites coming of age in the 1950s and 60s. And we think about the cookbooks that were prominent among Mennonites then, including the Mennonite Community Cookbook and community or congregational community cookbooks. Those themselves reflected the more insular nature of Mennonites and the deep denominational roots connecting them to a European past. But as Mennonites moved into the later part of the 20th century, the denomination began to change. Mennonites were losing their primarily rural identities. They were moving into cities and dispersing from the communities in which they were raised. They were becoming more invested in the world around them. And you can see this shift clearly in a cookbook like The Quintessentially Mennonite, More with Less, which was published by Herald Press in 1976. In many ways, Doris Longacre's text marks the transformation occurring in the Mennonite church at large. The book's pages reflecting the dominant denominational shifts that were occurring in the church. The More with Less holds in tension the paradox facing Mennonites in the late 20th century. The cookbook reaches into the past and into the deep roots of traditional Mennonite faith and praxis, while also looking to the future and to the assimilated identity Mennonites were beginning to assume. So Louis Neuswanger, who's a retired college librarian, was raising her children during the 1970s when The More with Less was published. And it became one of the books she used to feed her family. And although it offered some recipes from traditional Mennonite foods, it was groundbreaking for Mennonites because it included international cuisine and tips on how to cook healthy, low-cost meals, thus providing a challenge to Mennonites to attend more to the world around them as a witness to their faith. So Louise is going to share a little bit about her experience using the More with Less.
I was thinking about this assignment, reflecting. I made the comment to Carl that my husband, that I don't feel as connected to the Russian Mennonite. I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, east of Lancaster, 75 miles, and my ancestors came over in the late 1600s, early 1700s. So in our community, even though it was only 100 miles away from Lancaster, I reflected that we, our cooking was probably Pennsylvania German more than Mennonite cooking or Russian, you know, didn't have that ethnic connection. But before I talk about the More with Less, I at this point in my life, as many of you, we do sort of go through our childhood memories and we kind of sift through them and figure out, well, was it really the way we remember it? And I'm going to reflect on some of my family memories. But we lived on a small farm, 60 acres, and we had, it was a diversified farm, so we had animals as well as crops and a big garden. And we, part of my job was helping my mother pick out of the garden and then learn how to can the produce that we got. My father had a second job at an orchard to supplement the farm income, and I worked there at least 2 summers thinning peaches, and I can still feel that fuzz. Farming was hard work, and of course, I was very involved in it, although my brother always got to drive the tractors, and I had to collect the eggs and help out with milking. But food was an important part. In the summertime, as now, I can hardly wait till the heart of the garden begins to produce. And so memories of fresh string beans and potatoes from the garden cooked with a little bit of ham to flavor it, fresh tomato sandwiches and corn on the cob were some of my favorites. We had a little makeshift stand along the road, and we picked strawberries and sold them at our stand for 50 cents a quart in those days. And it was fun for us to sell we kids got to sell those along the road. And one summer there was a detour that came right by our stand, and so business was good, and we met a lot of interesting people traveling on their way to New York City and places in touristy things in our area. Apple butter was another staple that was a big part of our, we didn't use bread and butter, we used apple butter and bread. And with soup, it was wonderful. I asked my daughter if she could help me, or what were some of her favorite recipes that we cooked as she was growing up. And she recalled, this one is not in the More With Less cookbook, but we called it chopped beef potpourri. It was a hamburger, thick soup with potatoes and tomatoes. And I still make this recipe today. One other interesting note I recalled, and my sisters and I were reflecting on this summer. My father was a deacon in our church, and back in Pennsylvania, in my community, the deacon not only helped distribute, to the needy if there were special offerings, but one of his other tasks was to prepare the bread and wine for Communion Sunday. And so they, in our particular congregation, I don't know how it was done in other congregations, but he would order unsliced white bread from the bakery. That's the only time one of the few times we bought bread. And they would trim the crust off the bread and then slice that bread and make it into cubes that were the bread for our communion. They also used some of our home canned grape juice. But on Sunday evening, my sisters and I were reflecting, every time we had communion, we would have warm milk poured over the leftover bread from the communion, as well as the crust that they had cut off. And I don't remember if we added sugar or not, but that's a childhood memory that we all remembered and spoke about. I would say that my mother was doing More With Less cooking before there was a More With Less cookbook. She had a huge garden, a big freezer, and a designated storage space in our basement with canning shelves. And it was sort of a competition as to who could, how many quarts of this did you can in the summer, and how many quarts of that did you can? A few years ago, when we returned to visit the farmhouse with my siblings, the owners of this farmhouse, they had kept the essence of that house, which really made us feel good. But we were amused that the canning space in the cellar was now a wine cellar. So it was perfect for that. My parents were, I remember them for their hospitality and invitations to friends and strangers alike. We hosted family reunions and fresh air kids from New York City who would come out for a couple of weeks. So one Sunday, a woman showed up at our church, and she was a writer, and she was interested in writing about the Mennonites, I think. And so she came to the services and my mother invited her for dinner to our house several days later. So Addie Kent Thomas Jeffrey was her name. She wrote an article published in the Bucks County Traveler magazine in 1957 describing our family in very idyllic terms. I'd probably call it cheesy today, but I did enjoy rereading the author's description as she described our family when this article was published. The author's description of the dinner that she had at our house. And when she arrived at our house, my mother explained to the author, "Don't be expecting any Pennsylvania Dutch dinner now. You won't be seeing the cakes and pies lined up. My parents were Pennsylvania Dutch, all right, but my mother never let me experiment, afraid I'd waste something or make a mistake. I learned to cook by experience and Better Homes and Garden, and of course, the Mennonite Community Cookbook." Thomas Jeffrey noted the huge oak table in the kitchen, and that's where we always ate our meals, was hidden under curls of steam from bowls and platters, bright splashes of carrot salad, Better Homes and Gardens, and the deep brown of a generous meatloaf crowded side by side against scalloped potato white, Concord grape amethyst, I think she was describing the color, and the vivid tones of lima bean relish. We didn't have chow chow like they had in Lancaster. We had relishes, corn relish, lima bean relishes. Dessert included thick donuts served with succulent canned pears and peaches. Thomas Jeffrey was impressed that most of the meal had come from our garden and the fruit trees on our small farm. In addition to the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook, my mother had a recipe card collection with recipes from friends or gleaned from Better Homes and Gardens magazines each month. My mother's recipe collection included a basic chocolate cake recipe that I made so often I memorized it. Unfortunately, I no longer have it memorized. I usually made this cake on Saturday for company coming on Sunday. We had shoe fly pie occasionally, and also a cake called funny cake that had a chocolate sauce on the bottom. It was baked in a crust with cake on top of the chocolate sauce. But I believe, saying that my mother was a More With Us cook, I believe that More With Us cookbook, when it came out in 76, when we were raising our family, I believe that More With Us codified some of the practices that our parents were already following and reinforced for us the importance of continuing these practices at a time when our generation would be tempted to evaluate and discard much of the culture we grew up with. And parenthetically, I might say that when I was growing up, I felt more separated by dress patterns probably than I did by our cooking. Our cooking, I wouldn't say, was distinctive from our neighbors, that they pretty much probably cooked like we did if they lived in our farming community. So Carl and I were living in Bloomington, Illinois when in 1976, and Doris Jansen Longacre spoke to our women's group in 75, a year or so before it was published, and told about the project of collecting and testing recipes for a cookbook that embraced the ideas of cooking simple meals that were nutritious, tasty, and did not rely on overprocessed foods and were not destroying the earth by the use of poor farming methods. So people in my peer group bought up that cookbook. And later on, I've met friends over the years who were not from my Mennonite heritage who discovered that cookbook and who had some of the same values that we did and were embracing and interested in this cookbook. And so it not only became a bestseller in our community, but in our Mennonite community, but in other communities. I gave copies, and as many of you have perhaps, I gave copies to my daughter and my daughter-in-law when they married. This was the first cookbook where I recall reading large portions in the introductory section about nutrition and good stewardship of the earth. The cookbook was also promoting green before being green was the in thing. This cookbook emphasized the effects of our consumption on other parts of the world. More With Less encouraged our family to consume less animal protein, and we cooked more dishes with brown rice, beans, and lentils. In the years to come, we often had potlucks at our church where we were encouraged to bring a recipe that you've made from More with Less. The cookbook, More with Less in my cookbook collection is probably shows more wear and tear than any of the other cookbooks. There are many food stained pages indicating the recipes I use most often. And so when I was thinking about what were the recipes that our family used, all I had to do was look at the stained pages because I wasn't a very neat cook. And so our family favorites, honey baked chicken, taco salad, skillet cabbage, pumpkin custard, rhubarb salad, blender cranberry salad was one that, a blender cranberry salad was one I enjoyed making for Thanksgiving. The mashed potato casserole with spinach was a company favorite dish because I could make it a day ahead of time and heat it right before serving. And then I was talking to my daughter and I said, what do you remember about that? And she said, well, you always ask people if they could guess what was in your mashed potato casserole. And of course, people and kids who didn't like spinach would eat my mashed potato casserole because it was it didn't have that sharp flavor that I thought of with spinach when I was growing up. The soup section is probably the one I use most often, and the cheese and corn chowder because, again, it was a quick and easy recipe. I recently discovered a pumpkin soup recipe that is tasty with a few basic ingredients last fall when I had a lot of pumpkin, but I didn't want to get real fancy. I searched a lot of recipes on the internet and went back and discovered this one that for the minimum of ingredients, it's really a tasty recipe. And then I discovered that the person who contributed that was the mother of one of our friends we met along the way. Probably the fiasco, I tried spaghetti with zucchini, spaghetti squash with zucchini sauce, and that was probably my fiasco. And I never tried it again because it was just not very flavorful in my mind and a little bit too sloppy. I want to say that over the years, I've been employed a lot of the time while the kids were growing up, and so I do regret not spending as much time in the cooking with them as I would have liked. And I also want to share that my husband really pitched in. Whenever it kind of worked out that it fit his schedule to cook dinner or my schedule, that's how we decided who would do the cooking. And he's the one that makes the wonderful apple pie in our family. I'm proud to say that both my daughter and daughter-in-law are good cooks and have gardens, and they've integrated the More with Less at various times. My daughter has had to adjust her cooking to gluten-free and dairy-free for one of her children. My daughter-in-law, who did not grow up as, she wasn't of German heritage, she's Scottish and she grew up in Portland, but she, just embraces the More with Less cookbook, and she, probably more often now uses the Simply in Season cookbook. She has a garden, they both have gardens, but Sean especially cooks, cans produce from her garden, and I am so impressed she even cans fresh tuna off the boat. So they are surpassing me in my cooking, but so thank you.
Thank you, Louise. So in the years after Longacre's wildly successful book, other World Community Cookbooks published through MCC and marketed primarily to Mennonites, but to other readers as well, also emerged, continuing and expanding the ideology presented by More with Less. You can even see the different transformations occurring in the Mennonite church by looking at the title of the cookbooks from the 1950s, Mennonite Community Cookbook, to now we have the much broader World Community Cookbooks. The cookbooks published through the World Community brand, reflect the widening scope of Mennonites, their intensified longing to be working in the world, connecting with people of many different cultures. Mennonites are no longer just European descendants dining on Brenica. Mennonites are Vietnamese eating pho for breakfast, and Ghanaians enjoying groundnut stew, and Colombians serving barley soup to their families. I'm pleased to welcome Kathleen Hockman-Wirt of Corvallis, who's intimately familiar with the World Community Cookbook, as she served as editor for Simply in Season. She's going to share a little bit about her experience with the book and how working on this project has shaped her own understanding of Mennonitism, while also reflecting shifting concerns in the Mennonite church itself.
So in December of 2004, Mennonite Church USA then had a packet of resources for congregations called Equipping. They still have something sort of similar. And in December 2004, on the first page, I kept mine, there was a headline from Jim Schrag, the executive director of Mennonite Church USA, so our head honcho. And the headline of his little editorial is Healing and Hope, .. or Cookbooks, .. And he goes on to talk about living in Ohio and being offended to see newspaper ads for things like Amish turkeys and Mennonite food. And he asks the question, talks about being missional, and says, if there are transferable distinctives in our Mennonite identity, it is not in the food we eat, etc. And the final statement of the editorial is, do our words and actions produce healing and hope, or only more cookbooks? So this was about 6 months before Simply in Season came out. And that's why I kept it. I was so mad. in all fairness, I should be kind to Jim. But the top church leader really illustrates some of the sense of, frankly, frustration that was driving me to be involved with this project from the beginning. So I grew up with More With Less. I was 7 when it came out. And I always thought it was cool as I left my home congregation of Zion and went to Goshen for college and finally actually started meeting some people whose names were in More With Less as contributors of recipes. I thought, oh man, I want to have my name on a recipe. But as time went on, I was seeing, times were changing. The way we were eating was changing. We knew about Thai food. We knew about burritos. We knew about different pieces. So the foods were different, but I felt also that some of the issues were different. And what frustrated me was that I saw people who cared deeply about peace and justice issues, but I didn't see them making the connection between those issues and what their food choices were. Personally, as I was growing up, and this was deeply influenced by More With Less, I saw my values centered around eating cheaply and eating healthily. And certainly More With Less, as has been mentioned, does talk about other things. It was talking about, sustainable agriculture in times when we didn't use that phrase. But the thing that came out to me most was cheap and healthy. And I think I saw that in a lot of my peers and a lot of the church around me. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of emphasis on stewardship. I still hold to those values. But I was seeing that there was the times had changed so that there were other issues involved that had to do with economics, that had to do with why food is cheap. And what difference does it make if food is cheap here? What impact is that having on the environment, and what impact is that having on our global neighbors? So those were the issues that I hoped to address with Simply in Season, and in short, it happened. But I wasn't involved with MCC. I was working for Mennonite Women USA as an editor, and I started bugging MCC. It's like, you need to do a sequel to More With Less, and I think you should let me help. And I just kind of started bugging them, and Herald Press got excited about it because they knew that, you know, that More With Less was a bestseller for them. And so we took about a year to talk MCC into letting us do it. Mary Beth Lind, my co-author, became involved. I let her know about the project. I knew that she also shared my passion for these issues, and she offered to partner with me. She's a dietitian and nutritionist. I needed that. I was just coming with a journalism background. And so the two of us teamed up. We talked MCC into it. MCC was wonderful in giving us the support we needed to make it happen. And so we spent a year talking them into it and a year doing the book. So that's basically it. And as far as, you know, I could talk about some of the things that we came to these two organizations and what our arguments were at the time. And it had to do with talking about contemporary food issues from a faith basis. And that's the part, frankly, that interests me most in this whole discussion. I mean, it is certainly interesting to think about how foods are related to our history in terms of how they reflect the time and places that we were, how they do embody our values in terms of, you know, yes, the shared experience around the table, those relationships. But I never wanted to do a cookbook. I wanted to do a cookbook in the tradition of More With Less, because I saw that cookbook didn't just embody our values. It reinforced those values, and it shared those values. And I was getting, frankly, worried. I still worry. This is 8 years ago now that Simply in Season came out. And I was worried then, I worry now, that we're losing our values in terms of some of these simplicity issues. And I think it has been amazing to me. I mean, so this was, Jim Schrag was, you know, this was getting on, you know, 9 years ago. And I think if you look around the churches today, I think you see our Mennonite congregations cooking more of the local seasonal thing, and it kind of has caught on, and obviously our culture has gone more that way too than it was 10 years ago. So we weren't the only ones talking about this. But I think what we did have an impact and help to drive the conversation in that direction. I'm glad about that. It's interesting to me now to look at some of the discussion around these issues in Mennonite context and beyond. I really do think that if you want to influence the way people think and the way they behave, the best way to do it, in my opinion, is hymn writing. I think that those, you know, when you write a good hymn, that sticks deeply for a long time. So I think that's the best way. But I think the second best way is cookbooks, or at least it could be. And I think More With Less is our illustration of that. And I'm really proud, or if I can be so in a humble Mennonite context, but someone about my age, an AMB seminary graduate named Matthew Bailey Dick, has done some scholarly work on cookbooks. And he talked, I mean, I just want to read a few things that he said, because I think it's really interesting. He wrote, "Is there any significance to the fact that of the most popular books published by Mennonite, or by Herald Press, 3 out of the top 10 books are cookbooks, and 2 of these rank higher in sales than the Confession of Faith in a Mennonite perspective?" He wrote that. And he wrote, "Mennonite cookbooks often convey much more than just recipes for making particular foods. In fact, they become reflections of and even catalysts for change within Mennonite culture and theology." And then he goes on to talk about how More With Less is an expression of the original Anabaptist vision. He wrote, "The full extent of its impact can be seen in a rather surprising entry in the Canadian Mennonite Encyclopedia, in which the More With Less cookbook is the first in the list of examples of Anabaptist nonconformity, ahead of other examples such as conscientious objection and war tax withholding." And I think we continue to, this is not just old stuff. I think we see it continuing today. I was doing a little, just a web search to see what pops up. And I read someone's blog from a couple years ago talking about more with less. Again, he's saying this is not any old collection of recipes. This is a Mennonite crash course on a theology that impacts our lives. I mean, what more is Mennonitism about than theology that impacts our daily lives? And if we can do that in our food, that's huge, I think. Yeah, I think we are seeing it in some ways with Simply in Season. I've been really gratified to go on, you know, when I do a little search, I am seeing Catholics, Episcopalians, Christian Reformed, all using Simply in Season. We made a congregational Bible study resource out of it, hoping to spur these conversations. So in my dear friends in the Lutheran Church in Portland, they actually do training sessions where they bring in people from other churches to learn how to use Simply in Season and in their own small groups. So they're training the trainers, and they're Lutherans. So, you know, in short, I guess I care very deeply and am grateful to see the times when these cookbooks are shaping not just our own identity and reinforcing our own values, they're helping us encourage the broader Christian community and reach out beyond that to folks who wouldn't know us otherwise. So I did want to at least mention that for those of you familiar with the second in the series, the MCC series, Extending the Table, they are currently working on a 20th anniversary edition. So it'll be coming out soon. It's going to have lots of pictures, which is new. It's going to have a few new recipes and a few new stories. And if there are recipes that you really like in Extending the Table, hang on to your old copy because they're not all in there because they had to take some out to make room for the new ones. Thank you.
Very much. So for our last speaker today, we want to think about the contemporary conversations that are continuing among Mennonites that revolve around what it even means to be a Mennonite, when church membership is growing faster in the global south, when Mennonites are increasing the urban, when many join the Mennonite church from other faith traditions. What does it mean now to be a Mennonite? How do those who aren't connected to Mennonites by ethnicity, who can't play the Mennonite game very well, still find their place at the table? We're going to hear from somebody who came to the church, not through the ethnic routes, but otherwise, and who has sometimes felt like an outsider because of a lack of connection through Mennonite ethnicity. Don Bacher is going to pinch hit for Judy here and share about how discussions around Mennonite food has sometimes made him feel like an outsider.
I would be very remiss if I said I was taking my wife's place. So some of you, someone out there may have her speech, and if you do, I guess you can read and see what she was going to say. I made a few notes. When Melanie was putting this together, she and I kind of talked about how this was going to work, and the thing that she came up with was, what about those of us who don't come from the Mennonite tradition? She was born and raised a Mennonite, but I wasn't. I was a Methodist for years, and then got connected up with these Mennonite folks, and for a little while I was a Methonite, and then I became a Mennonite. So I didn't grow up with anything that you've talked about today. And I'm sure that Judy didn't have a whole lot of the same kind of food traditions necessarily that's been talked about. My first connection with any kind of ethnic Mennonite food was back in the mid-60s when I went to Goshen College, and I was in the touring choir, and one of our stops was Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And the host family that I stayed with after the choir concert, we went to the local, would be comparable, I suppose, to Yogurt Extreme or something like that, the soda shop at that point. And I had shoo fly pie and peanut butter ice cream. And I'm not sure why that combination, but I was excited because I had heard about shoo fly pie since my Mennonite connections and had no clue. And I liked it. I've never had shoo fly pie and peanut butter ice cream since, but that was my first connection with this ethnic thing. In the mid-70s, we went to Jamaica for 2 years with MCC, and we had a fairly large MCC group at that time. And in fact, it was the same year that Ken Snyders and Stan and Marlene Krupp were there. So that kind of shows you what period of time was. Anyway, we had a lot of Canadians as part of our group, and they were General Conference. And, you know, my understanding of what GCs were graduates of Goshen College. I didn't know what this General Conference stuff was all about. But I discovered really quickly at our first, at our Christmas retreat, when we started planning the retreat, that there was some discrepancies here. There was our songs and their songs, and our food and their food. Well, as far as I was concerned, it was food, you know. I know there was a difference. And so they were, the Canadian Mennonites were talking about Zwieback and borscht and rollkuchen and watermelon and, you know, what did I know about that stuff? It was chicken and bread and cookies and whatever. So that was this outsider's introduction to some Mennonite ethnic traditions. We came back from Jamaica, and what we brought with us was the beginnings of our own family traditions. And I think, at least from our perspective, we don't really think about our food as Mennonite or ethnic. It's just the Bakker tradition, the Bakker food. One of the things that has become very a part of our lives, one of the things that we picked up while we were in Jamaica, the major food meal on Sunday for most Jamaicans is what is fried chicken and rice and peas. And those of you that have connections with Puerto Rico or may have some idea as to what the rice and peas is, it's rice and pinto beans, not peas. But it's fixed with, there's scallion and thyme and coconut milk. And it's awesome. And so our Thanksgiving dinner every year when all our kids are together is we have fried chicken and rice and peas. I mean, and that's standard. We don't do ham or any of the other stuff. It's, or turkey, fried chicken, rice and peas. And then Judy makes an orange jello salad and a green jello salad with cottage cheese. And if we didn't make those, the girls would complain. So those are things that have become part of our tradition. And Judy makes coconut cookies that are to die for, which we brought today. And my thing has become peanut brittle at Christmas time. So. We have developed our own kinds of traditions, and even though I personally can't hearken back to Russian food or Mennonite ethnic things, so we have our own ethnic stuff.
Thank you very much, Don. I think all our families could probably share the ways we've formed our own traditions and how those as well reflect historical and cultural movements, larger historical and cultural movements. Although many of us have pretty complex relationships with food, and though our quickened society means we often eat meals on the go, as Megan pointed out at the beginning, with the Keurig soup, or we eat in our cars or over the sink or at our work desks, there's something still about meals that can tie us together as family and brothers and sisters of God. We're gonna have some time for sharing, but we've kind of run out of time, so Don's gonna close, or Don and Jerry will close for us, and then we can continue to share around the table in the fellowship hall. So, Don.